Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Hey, folks, I'm Megan McCarty-Carino. I'm in for Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you for joining us for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, the day in the week where we answer listener questions with the help of our wonderful team over here at Make Me Smart.
If you've got a question about the economy or business or tech, email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-UBSMART, which I've kind of been wondering, why isn't it You Are Smart? I'm just saying. Today we have
no,
a couple questions.
It's where the number is. It's the number. Like, because the R is a different number on the phone.
Well,
it's,
I know, like, but why couldn't we make it? Whatever.
Because,
we should have done it with proper grammar. I'm just saying.
Well, no, but so no, this is actually a fun story. When the number first came out, it wasn't like anything related to it. It's just like one of the listeners recognized the UB Smart.
Are you
kidding
me?
And so that was like added to it later
just
on.
It was just kismet?
Sure. I don't know what kismet means, but I'm going to go with it.
Like a
and
happy
then
coincidence.
I think the smart part may have been planned, but the UB,
okay.
I don't think so.
Okay, gotcha. Well, anyway, now that we've settled that, we do have a couple questions today about the Inflation Reduction Act, which we've talked a little bit about this week, but, you know, it's dense. It has a funny kind of name that is not super descriptive, but we're talking about the climate bill, which included tax stuff, included also, you know, drug price stuff. So let's hear it.
Hey, Make Me Smart team. This is Zach from Berkeley, California. I'm thinking about the climate bill that just passed that also has a number of prescription drug elements to it. I was wondering, if they bring down the prices for prescription drugs for Medicare, which is the goal, will that bring down prescription drug prices for everyone? Thanks.
Oh, wouldn't that be lovely? But no, is the short answer. It would be nice, but no. Look, the biggest effect of this is going to be on people with prescription drug coverage through Medicare, which is a big chunk of people. It's 18.4% of the U.S. population in 2020, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. So specifically, the way that the bill brings down drug costs for Medicare is it allows the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate directly with pharmaceutical companies a certain number of drugs each year for Medicare. Plus, it puts a $2,000 per year cap in out-of-pocket costs for prescription drugs for those on Medicare. So it lowers those costs two ways. The drugs are going to be cheaper, and the total out-of-pocket costs for people on Medicare is going to be cheaper. It also requires drug makers to offer rebates to Medicare if they raise the price of medicines faster than the, you know, inflation, although this year would probably be great for them because that means they could jack it up like 8.5-9%. But we talked to James Robinson, a professor of health economics from the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, about this. And he said that really there's not going to be much impact for non-Medicare patients because it's really hard for Congress to pass legislation that will affect non-Medicare patients given the current dynamic of things. So here's how that works. Every so often you'll hear us talk about things getting through the Senate based on like reconciliation or something like that, which allows them to pass things with that party line vote, 50-50, with the vice president breaking the tie. But those votes have to have something to do with like the budget, right? And so if you say, hey, this is something that affects Medicare, all right, fine. That has to do with the budget because the federal government pays for Medicare. If you're saying, hey, we want to shape how the private industry pays for drug prices, that's outside of the realm. Right. And so you need 60 votes to get that passed. And so they did try to slip it in, but it didn't work because it didn't apply to the budget. And the Senate parliamentarian was like, no go. So anyway, this current bill only affects the public program passed with the 50 Democratic votes plus the one tiebreaker from Vice President Harris. All the Republicans opposed. We spoke to another expert, Juliette Kubanski, Deputy Director of the Program on Medicare Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. So much Kaiser this week. Kaiser Family Foundation is different from Kaiser Health News.
Indeed.
FYI. Yes. But she confirms that it mostly affects people on Medicare. One provision might have spillover effects on the other types of insurance, which is the requirement for those rebates that drug makers have to pay if they raise prices over the cost of inflation. You know, that could lead pharmaceutical companies to introduce new drugs at higher prices than they might otherwise because it makes it harder for them to raise those prices later. But look, already new drugs are very expensive, especially today compared to like a decade ago. And so, you know, it's hard to tell if that concern is something that the industry is putting out there to try to, you know, avoid this from happening in the first place, or if it's real. But, you know, at least for the people on Medicare, older Americans, Americans with disabilities, some people who have extreme health concerns, you know, they're gonna feel some relief. So,
Yeah, I've seen some concerns voiced by business groups too, that, you know, for employer-based health plans that, you know, this is total speculation that, you know, perhaps pharmaceutical companies could try to recoup some of those costs by raising prices for those private plans, you know, that are sponsored by employers. That is just something that I've seen concerns about. I think, you know, all of this is very complicated and has yet to, you know, we don't know all the potential ramifications, but yeah, I mean, it's the start of something in terms of, you know, drug prices. I know this has been a very, very long time coming, this kind of, you know, even just doing it through Medicare.
Yeah. All right, let's go to our next question, which is also tied to the Inflation Reduction Act.
This is Jim from Las Vegas, and I would like to know how the 15% minimum corporate tax on over $1 million in profit would apply and what it would mean for several companies like Amazon, Tesla, or the big oils. They have other deductions to get around it. If not, how much additional income would the government get from their taxes? That's it. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, I think this is something that there's broad sort of agreement about when you hear about these extremely lucrative, you know, companies and that they paid very little or no corporate taxes. It's always a little bit jarring. Mm-hmm. And as he mentioned, you know, Amazon, Tesla, Meta, you know, all these big companies, there have been in recent years these stories about how they've paid, in some cases, no taxes during years where they have appeared to have, you know, very big profits. So this 15% minimum corporate tax, it's basically, you know, it's part of how Democrats plan to pay for all the hundreds of billions of dollars in energy and climate technology investments in this bill that we talked about earlier this week. And this is, it's sort of, you know, it's not like a first line solution. It's not raising the corporate tax. It's not closing, you know, a lot of these deduction loopholes, but it's an attempt to close some loopholes in the tax code that have let these very big profitable companies like Amazon and Tesla essentially pay very little. Currently, the corporate tax rate is 21%. This is an effort to get them a little closer to paying their fair share. And so how it would work is, you know, according to an analysis in the Washington Post, companies with at least $1 billion in income would be required to calculate their annual tax liability in two ways. So the first is kind of the usual way that they calculate it for tax purposes, which is 21% of profits less deductions and credits, which is where those, you know, those deductions come in for those companies that really shrink their tax liability. There are all kinds of deductions, you know, depreciation of all of their capital investments and those kinds of things. This would require another calculation applying the 15% minimum rate to the earnings they report to shareholders on their financial statements, which is a little different. This is known as book income. So whichever amount is greater, that would be what they owe. Now, this is how it works in theory. In practice, tax experts aren't totally convinced that this is, you know, going to necessarily make it so that all those big companies end up paying what, you know, I think people would consider to be their fair share. They still have a lot of options for getting around, you know, those deductions are a pretty big thing. And then on top of that, it just
accountants make their money.
Exactly. You know, and I mean, it's all in the tax code. They find their ways. But ultimately, this just really wouldn't apply to very many companies. You know, the Joint Committee on Taxation estimated earlier in the bill's life cycle that it would affect maybe 150 companies would be subject to this tax. That was before there were some last-minute changes to exempt companies controlled by private equity firms. That was kind of the little thing that Kristen Sinema got in the bill before she agreed to support it. So it was originally estimated to generate maybe $300 billion over 10 years. Now it's closer to $200 billion. And this is separate from the 15% global minimum tax that folks are talking about kind of on the global stage. You might have heard about European Union. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is working on this with OECD companies. A lot of them have signed on, which would target companies, you know, moving their headquarters, their sort of financial headquarters, to these low tax havens to get out of paying taxes in the countries that they actually do business. That's still in process.
Whew. Taxes. That was a lot.
That was kind of enough talk of taxes maybe for today.
Well, and I think we're going to be unpacking this for months. This is such a huge piece of legislation that touches so many parts of the economy.
I know, and every piece of it is so complicated. We could do we could do an entire show on each little piece of it. So, all right, next question of the day. Let's hit it.
Hi, my name is Ben from Austin, Texas. I was calling to see if you could help make me smart about a phrase that keeps popping up in the discussion around inflation. And the phrase is people who are living paycheck to paycheck, or just this idea of paycheck to paycheck in general. Is paycheck to paycheck supposed to refer to just those on fixed incomes, the elderly, the disabled, etc.? Or is it really apply to all of us, and how should we think about it when we hear it?
I think this is an example of one of those imprecise bits of language we use in journalism, and we just need to do better. Because there isn't a single clear definition of what paycheck to paycheck means. I mean, look, all of us that get a paycheck, which not everybody does. Some people are paid in different ways. You know, we spend that paycheck on different things, and then we get the next one, spend that on different things. So, but generally speaking, though, people are using it to refer to folks who don't have a lot of savings and need that next paycheck to cover their basic expenses like rent, food, and bills. At least that's how Investopedia and several other groups describe it. But at the same time, other people use it as a shorthand for the working poor, which isn't really fair because you can have people making up in the six figures who, you know, either live exactly at their means or beyond their means and need each paycheck to keep it up. And there are several reports out there that talk about how many Americans are living paycheck to paycheck with various definitions depending on who's doing the polling. And it ranges from like 50 to 63%. And again, it just depends on how it's defined. And so you really do have to pay attention to the fine print. Well, not really. I mean, if you think about it, that's half of Americans who need their next paycheck to pay the bills that they have coming up. That could be a perfectly responsible way of living, you know, as long as you have a paycheck. It just doesn't leave you much wiggle room. And you know, with rising housing costs, so many people are spending, you know, 30, 40, 50% of their income on housing. How could you not live paycheck to paycheck? So anyway, there are it means a lot of things to different people. Mm-hmm. And there's no exact definition, but it doesn't. Some people use it as shorthand for the working poor, mm-hmm. but that's not really an accurate shorthand because there are plenty of people making a lot of money but still living paycheck to paycheck.
At Marketplace, when we used to do those polls every now and again, those surveys that we used to do, I think we had a question
economic
that we always would include.
Polls.
That's right, the Economic Anxiety Index that we used to do. We always used to have a question in there. It was one of our standard questions, I think, you know, are you prepared for a $500 emergency? And I think during the pandemic, we added, are you prepared for a $250 emergency? And yeah, the percentage of people who said no, even to the $250 emergency, was strikingly high, and particularly, you know, during those early months of the pandemic when unemployment was skyrocketing and people, you know, couldn't get their unemployment checks and all that stuff. But yeah, no, I mean, it is always kind of striking to realize that is the situation for such a majority of people.
Yeah. Well, what a lovely, happy up note to end on. But that is it for us today. Thank you for listening. Make Me Smart is going to be back tomorrow with some news, and this time we'll actually have some Make Me Smiles.
All right. In the meantime, please keep sending your questions. Our email again is makemesmart@marketplace.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 508-UBSMART, which I now realize is proper grammar if you're speaking in the imperative sense. You be smart.
Oh. Sure. Let's go with that.
It's a command.
Make Me Smart is, yes, it's a command. You be smart. Be best. Anyway, Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera. Olivia Chow is our intern. Ellen Rolfus writes our newsletter.
Today's show was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. And our senior producer is Bridget Bodner.
That was nice timing on that ending there, Megan.
Hey.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.